Today on Off Mic, as the world awaits the finale of the presidential campaign, we talk about the state of national politics and in Northwest Indiana. We also talk to the newest member of the Gary School Board and plans for the future. But of course, the big news is the presidential race. We may get some breaking news during this hour. So hold on to your seat, sit back and listen and enjoy the show. So all this coming up on Off Mic. Welcome to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente, reporter with WBEZ in Chicago. Well, today is going to be a sort of fly-by-the-seat-of-your-pants type show. We know that the world is awaiting word from the outcome of the presidential election. The AP could call it at any moment for Democratic Joe Biden, and if that happens, we'll go to live special coverage from National Public Radio. But that may not happen at this hour. It could come later today or sometime after that, or maybe never. But we'll, especially this hour, we'll just monitor the news for you. However, to give you the latest on where the presidential race stands now is Lakeshore Public Radio's Tom Maloney. Hey, Tom, how are you?
Mike, good morning.
Good morning to you.
To election day number three.
That's right. That's right. It's going to be sort of an election night central right here tonight. Well, just during the show for Off Mic, minus, of course, the chicken wings and the pizza and all the candy and the goodies we had that night. But we're still going to have fun. Okay. So, you know, if most of you folks are probably, whether you're a political junkie or not, you know that there's this big presidential race, and we're all awaiting word as to who's going to win. Is it going to be called soon or not? The pandemic, of course, has caused a lot of issues with counting the votes. Millions of people use that mail-in, early voting, mail-in ballot, and that's causing the counting of the votes to take painstakingly slow. And that's because also a lot of these states, you got to think about this. This is not a national election. These are almost 50 small countries doing their own election with their own rules and with their own laws of when they can count the early ballots, when they can't do it, how they can do it, a process. And that's leading to a little confusion, and it's taking a long time. What do you think about that, Tom?
Mike, I think that's something that I don't think a lot of people necessarily realize is, you know, the elections are not a federal process. They are a local state process. Secretary of State is the person who oversees the elections in each individual state, meaning there are 51 or 52. I don't know how many secretaries of state there are. There's one for each state. Then you've got Washington, D.C. You've got Puerto Rico. You've got, of course, all of
Guam
and the Virgin Islands and all these other territories that the United States has. I'm not sure how that worked, but here in Indiana, we have a Secretary of State who oversees our elections. And, you know, there's more than just a president on every single ballot. There are Senate races. There are House races. There are county races here in Northwest Indiana for both Lake, Porter, and LaPorte counties. So, you know, it's civics 101, and it's always a shame that people are learning about civics 101 when it comes time to cast the ballot and not beforehand.
And that's true. And civics 101, you almost had to have to brush it off and add an addendum because of the pandemic. There was so much going on. We do know here in Indiana, back in the primary, the votes, there was a 10-day grace period. And of course, remember, our actual primary was supposed to be in early May. It was pushed back to early June to accommodate because we were going through the early stages of the pandemic. And of course, you know, the pandemic is not over with. But there was no type of safeguards or leeway for the general election. Indiana, there was a court challenge. Indiana said that all the ballots, the mail-in ballots, had to be in by noon on election day. Some states have it, like Pennsylvania, 3 days after the election. It has to be postmarked on election day. And some places just did not give that leeway. And this is all decided by state legislatures, by law. So this isn't a, you know, middle of the night change of plans, changing the rules. This is how it's spelled out. And of course, we do know it's going to be weeks before the actual vote count for each state is actually going to be certified. And we haven't even gotten to their electoral count election.
That's right. And you throw into the mess of all of that. President Trump has already announced that he's filing a recount in Wisconsin. He plans on filing a recount in Pennsylvania. We'll probably have a recount in Georgia as well. As the Secretary of State said earlier this morning, that Georgia expects to do a recount regardless of whether or not the president files one or not, because the votes are so close. Mike, I have the most recent update from Georgia right now. Joe Biden leads President Donald Trump by 1,584 votes, and roughly 4,602 votes are left. So, I mean, we are literally getting down to the bottom of the barrel in the state of Georgia. But we, like you said, we won't know those specific results for weeks. But that's also not uncommon. You know, more often than not, when we learn, okay, you know, candidate A or candidate B has won on election night or the day after, right? We have some sort of an update. We have an idea. But if you go back and check those maps, it's 85% reporting in one state. It's 98% reporting in another state. It's still not 100% reporting for days, because all of these states have that extended grace period to go ahead and make sure all ballots are accounted for, making sure that all ballots that should be counted are counted, and putting aside ballots that are in question and allowing those voters then to either, you know, bring in an ID or make sure their signature matches or come back and sign the back of an envelope. There are so many things that happen through all of those processes that it does take a while for the 100% initial vote to go through.
That's right. That's right. Then you're out. There's also these provisional ballots, which we kind of brush aside. But in tight races, every vote is going to matter. So this is where, you know, the electorate, and me included, we're all just waiting word. It could still take some time, and we should allow all the votes to be counted, no matter what your political persuasion, no matter if you're a Donald Trump supporter or a Joe Biden supporter or Libertarian supporter. We should count all the votes, the military votes, and, you know, let the chips fall where they may. Now, a lot of these court challenges are going to, you know, there's also every state, it hinges on what the state law allows. It has to be within a certain percentage point.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if it stays the same in Georgia where they are in a statistical dead heat, well, you know, I think you probably want to recount there. Of course, tossing out thousands of ballots because, you know, you're thinking of fraud. And I mean, fraud is a huge, big word. That's just, I wish people wouldn't go there. But if that's the language they want to use, maybe invalid or past the time, whatever, they'll get to the bottom of it. But they're out and out fraud. It just seems unlikely for that to be fraud.
And I'll bring this up, too. You're hearing people on social media especially claiming that Democrats are finding the votes. President Trump even alluded to it in both press conferences that he's had over the last 48 hours, one from election day that night, and then the other one obviously yesterday, that, quote unquote, they have found missing votes or ballots, and insinuating that it is the Democrats who are finding enough ballots to push Joe Biden over the edge, when in reality, this is the result of the pandemic. A lot of people voted by mail. A lot of people were able to vote by mail. Unlike here in Indiana, I myself had, and my wife, we had to go to the polls on election day because, we could vote early, but I'm a stickler for voting the day of if I'm not voting by mail. But the governor and the Secretary of State of Indiana had decided that the coronavirus was not a legitimate cause for voting by mail. And that's a decision that we have granted them as voters when they are elected and put into office. And so you look at all of these other states like Pennsylvania, who maybe don't deal with a lot of mail-in voting. Georgia doesn't deal with a lot of mail-in voting. But you look at states like Washington and Oregon, Colorado, who have really, really strong systems set up to handle mail-in voting, they're getting those numbers in right away without issue because they know how to do it. They know how to process the ballots. They know the process that it takes for the ballots to go through, be counted, get applied, get the numbers updated. Some other states, you know, I don't want to say they're learning on the fly, but they're not used to such a heavy load of mail-in ballots like other states are.
That's right. That's right. And of course, it's still going to take some time to count every vote. There's so many things out there. Yeah, you know, there is definitely a lot of noise out there, especially coming from the Trump campaign. Now, people say, well, they like Trump because he's not a politician. It makes you wonder if he actually knows the process or understands the process of the election, because sometimes things that he says makes you wonder if he fully understand how the process actually works. And again, we haven't even gotten to the electorates to start voting on this. That's still going to take some time. And then who knows, that could probably create its own controversy as we get down over there. Yes.
Yeah. Something else that's popped up. You bring up the Electoral College, Mike, and people have talked about, well, what if there's a tie 269 to 269 and, you know, the Democrats control the House, so obviously Joe Biden wins that. Well, not so fast. The process itself is every state votes as a block. And so in the state of Indiana, when you have nine House of Representatives and seven of them are Republicans and two of them are Democrats, it's not that Andre Carson and Frank Mervan get to vote for Joe Biden and those votes apply to Joe Biden. They vote for Biden, but they're outruled by the five other members of the Republicans in Indiana. So Indiana votes as a block for Donald Trump. So if that's the case, the U.S. House of Representatives, while controlled by Democrats, would actually end up voting for Donald Trump because there are quite literally more red states than there are blue states. And so that's something that I think a lot of people also need to be aware of, is that just because something looks as it does on the surface, you do have to dig a little bit deeper. But realistically, we're probably not looking at a 269 tie. At this point, Joe Biden only needs to win one of Arizona, Georgia, Nevada, North Carolina, or Pennsylvania to go ahead and be the next president of the United States.
That's right. That's right. All right. Okay. So we're going to take a little break here. And when we come back, we're going to talk to a local official about some of the local and national politics. We're going to, later on in the show, we're also going to talk to a newest member of the Gary Community School Board and about her plans for the future on that board. And as the Gary just passed a huge referendum for more money for the Gary schools. So we got a lot to talk about coming up in the show. We may even get a sports update, considering we're still awaiting word, but as of right now, we're 20 minutes into the show. We're kind of safe. We're going to try to get in the whole show. So we'll be back with more Off Mic. Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. I'm sitting alongside Lakeshore Public Radio's Vice President for radio programming, Tommy Maloney. Tom, how you doing?
Well, Mike, it's election day, day three, and I think I've drank more coffee over the last 72 hours than I've probably drank in a long, long time.
And we do know that a lot of people nationally and here locally are paying attention to the presidential races, but local issues are also dominating here. And on the phone with us is joining us by Tony Walker, an attorney out of Gary. He's also a former member, head of the Indiana Judicial Disciplinary Commission. Tony, how are you?
Good morning. How are you, sir?
Good. Thank you for joining us here on Off Mic. I know you are a political beast just like I am. It's probably just waiting on pins and needles as who's going to win this presidential race. Tony, as we're awaiting word and you're looking at some of the trends out there, what are some of the things that kind of stuck out in your mind on the presidential race, either locally or nationally?
I think it's been a real excellent test of our democracy. I just remember so many times having been involved in education and speaking to a lot of school-age kids, and you try to convince them that, hey, every vote really counts. But this is the first time, I would say, in my 53 years where you can actually see that play out. So I think it's a very healthy thing for the overall democratic system in the country for us to go through this process. of actually giving value and seeing the value of every vote in slow motion, as Tom mentioned. A lot of extra coffee with this one.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And when you know, there's been a lot of talk about how Republicans seem to have attracted a higher percentage of African-American votes, Donald Trump with African-American community and with Hispanics. What does that tell you? One, do you believe that? Or does that also tell you that Democrats may have to do a better job in appealing to a base that maybe they're, quote unquote, taking it for granted?
Yeah, I mean, I think there were some political strategies that both sides undertook. I was more involved with the Democratic Party strategy, obviously, because one of my capacities, I'm with the City of Gary, Indiana Democratic Party Central Committee as a legal advisor to our city party chairman, Mayor Jerome Prince. And one of the discussions I know that I had with some of our state party officials was about the strategy of Biden just sort of focusing the run on the idea of vote for me because I'm not Trump. Personally, I never really felt that was enough. I felt there needed to be an economic focus. One of the things that I think is interesting, Mike, across party lines here, a lot of the people that are feeling disaffected in the Democratic Party and a lot of the people that are feeling disaffected in the Republican Party are actually the victims of the same economic circumstance. And they're manifesting that totally opposite, in selecting of either Trump or Biden for president. So I felt the messaging of the Biden campaign could have been more targeted and more clear around economic issues. I felt it wasn't enough just to say vote for me because I'm not Trump.
Sure. You know, taking a look a little bit closer to home in the state of Indiana, we do know Governor Eric Holcomb won re-election to his second four-year term, Republican over Democrat Dr. Woody Myers. Tony, what does the Democratic Party have to do now? It almost feels like it needs to almost start from the bottom up to just reestablish of what party they are, because they're starting to lose. It felt like of any year, this could have been a really good year for the Democrats in the state of Indiana. Of course, you were going up against a Republican incumbent governor and with Donald Trump on the ballot. But what do Democrats on the state level have to do to become relevant again?
Well, I mean, as it relates to state party, one of the low points of watching the election return was after, you know, working hard for months and months to turn out the vote. And, you know, our numbers were all of over 60% in Lake County. Now, that's a huge jump for Lake County turnout. And it didn't get quite up to where we were in 08 with the Obama campaign at 70%. But people came out and voted in droves across Lake, Porter and LaPorte. I think Porter was around 66%. LaPorte was over 60%. But yet and still, with all of that turnout and a lot of extra Democratic turnout even across the state, do you know that the networks basically called Indiana at 6:01 p.m.?
Oh, right.
It was the first state to be called. So you see all of that work going into getting out the vote, and there's this sense that, okay, it didn't even make a minute's worth of difference. And to your point and what we discussed earlier, I think we have to refine the messaging as a state party. But beyond refining the message, we have to also acknowledge this race this year is a little different because of the racial polarization across the country and across the state, and also because of the personality cult that Donald Trump has built up in terms of being able to drive people to the polls in particularly rural areas. So
right.
We sort of had a double whammy in having to navigate through racial divisions across the country and in the state. We even had a mayor leave the party over the course of this election,
right,
around some of these issues. So, and then you also had what I haven't seen before in my lifetime, where someone that is just particularly skilled at attaching people to his personality and driving otherwise people that may not be voters to the polls than Donald Trump.
Do you feel the Republican Party, if you know, we're not saying he has yet, but if Donald Trump was to not win re-election, will the Republican Party have maybe it will need to reinvent itself in a post-Donald Trump era.
Well, you know, there'll be a lot of debate around this, but my position has been, and I think maybe, Mike, we've communicated about this a little bit, that Trump is going to be the face and the leader of the Republican Party for at least the next few years, I believe. Because the fact of the matter is, he saved probably a lot of Republican establishment candidates across the country that otherwise would have been caught up in this Democratic wave, but for not only him turning out the Trump supporters, but getting them to vote down ballot on the Republican ticket. So because of that, and because there's just no rival right now to him in the Republican Party, right now the Republican congressional leadership and everyone just seems to be hunkered down in their bunkers, afraid to even speak about what's going on with this national play out of the counting of the vote. So I don't think there's a challenge to him. It's just going to be a matter of what he wants to do with it for the next several years.
Early into his tenure in his first term, it seemed like, you know, for all intents and purposes, he was actually helping Northwest Indiana. Yeah, I mean, given his personality and his Twitter account, that aside, he really took a strong stance, unlike Republicans in the past, against foreign steel dumping. Of course, Gary, Indiana and Northwest Indiana, the bread and butter is still steel, and he helped protect that industry. Then the second thing, which is a major economic driver in Northwest Indiana, is renaming the or designating the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore into a national park. So while this area is a strong, historically Democratic area, those two things by President Donald Trump, I thought maybe, oh my God, he might actually siphon away a lot of Democratic votes to his side in the next election.
And that's sort of the tragedy of that administration. I guess historians will have to dig into this, but there were good arguments to be made on the policy side. I mean, not only for Indiana, like you pointed out, but even for Black Americans. I mean, there were some policy gains that Trump could have legitimately argued and campaigned on, which he actually tried to do. But the fact of the matter is, as a leader, his personality was so divisive, and he bent toward the divisiveness in the country instead of the healing of the country, that I think it just totally undermined the good works that his administration may have done.
You know, a lot of people talk about when you become the president, you kind of grow into that. The office is so big that, you know, it overwhelms you. It just doesn't seem, you know, he could still pull this out and go to a second term. But if he does that, this first term, he didn't seem to mature into being the president. He seems like he didn't mature from this Donald Trump to President Donald Trump.
Well, Mike, you can't really stop being who you really are, okay? I mean, whatever jobs I've had over my life, I've brought Tony to that position. I can't somehow bifurcate, I'm going to be this actor in this role and not be myself. And I think overwhelmingly you just see that with Donald Trump, that whatever he's done professionally throughout his career, he's always been Donald Trump. So like Dennis Edwards said after the Bears game, oh, he is who we thought he was.
That's right. That's right. Okay, Tony Walker, attorney in Gary, Indiana, thank you so much for joining here on Off Mic, and have a great day.
All right, you too, and thanks for the opportunity, Mike.
No problem, and we'll be back with more Off Mic. Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente, reporter with WBEZ in Chicago. Well, of course, we've been, you know, focused on the presidential race and local politics, but we want to get really close to local politics. And in Gary, Indiana, the Gary Community Schools had an election, and Akilia McCain is one of the victors in that race. Akilia, welcome to Off Mic.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for joining us here. Akilia, let me ask you this. Why did you want, this was your first foray into politics, correct?
Yes, indeed.
Why this race? Why this board?
Well, I am a longtime resident of Gary, Indiana. My parents were both reared here. I went through the Gary public school system, as did my husband, Trent A. McCain. And I, my parents, my mother was a longtime teacher, as were my, and retired as a principal after 35 years in the Geary Community School Corporation. My family was there. I was there as a child. So it just, I've always had an interest in the goings on of our public schools here in the city.
Now, we do know right now the Geary schools are under the emergency manager with the Geary School Board. What is the role of the Geary School Board under this emergency management system?
Well, right now, the Geary School Board is limited to holding 4 meetings per year. The emergency manager, Dr. Paige McNulty, is handling the day-to-day happenings of the school. So we're basically advising the school, the emergency manager. But right now, I view it as a really special time. I know a lot of people, a lot of the citizens of Geary were really upset about what happened. But, you know, what happened, happened, and it happened some time ago. So my plan is to just move forward and work with everyone who is involved in the Geary Community School, all of the stakeholders, from Dr. Paige McNulty to state legislators, any stakeholders, parents, teachers, ancillary service providers, to work with them to learn this system inside and out. So when those 2 years, we're looking at 2 more years of the emergency manager being in place, and then their contract is up. And that will be 2 years into my 4-year term. So I'm just wanting to be extremely prepared and have plans in place to move into place once those 2 years are up, so that we can move the schools forward and have world-class schools for the children of Geary, because they certainly deserve that.
Now, Akilia, we do know that Geary voters recently approved on Tuesday a referendum that will provide more than $71 million in new funding for the Geary Community Schools over the next 8 years. Where did you come on that referendum? Were you for it or against it?
Well, I didn't take a stance on the referendum. I decided to let the citizens of the city make their decision on that. My goal was always to work for the schools and to be on the school board to make decisions with whatever decision was made. We still have to move forward. Whatever the citizens decided, we still need schools that are world-class schools and functioning schools. So I stayed out of that and decided to let the citizens decide. But I am indeed glad to see that they decided to fund the schools and that we will have monies available to us during my term that we will use wisely, that we'll be very wise and prudent with.
Yeah, and it does look like, I talked to the head of the Gleneva Dunham earlier in the week about what it means for the Geary schools. It looks like the Geary teachers haven't had a raise in 12 years, so $1 million of that is already going to go for teacher raises, and also to pay down this deficit. I believe there's a $6 million budget deficit that they're going to try to wipe out. So it seems like the money is going to be put to good use. But as a school board member, are you going to be monitoring that they make sure? I mean, it's not every day Geary gets a new pot of money to use from. Yeah. You got to, you know, use it wisely. And I think that's what got Geary in trouble, the Geary School Board in trouble in previous years, just not really being a really good fiscal manager of that money. Are you going to, like, try to just keep track of where that money's going?
Oh, sure. It's our responsibility to be wise stewards of the taxpayers' money, and our responsibility to use that student, that money, in the best way, in the way that will benefit our students. They're certainly deserving of it. There are so many things that are needed. And I would like to back up and just acknowledge what you said about the teachers. They are so deserving of this raise. They have been with us for a long time and suffered a long time. I mean, actually, they've come in at a loss every year, not just having a cost of living raise. So I'm so glad to see that they'll be rewarded for their loyalty to the children of Geary. And And as far as the money and the fiscal responsibility, I certainly will be keeping a close eye on that and making the best choices and researching, you know, everything before we make any kind of decisions related to the spending of those dollars.
You know, Akilia, there are so many people outside the city of Gary that have written off the city, written off the residents, the school district as just unfixable. You still live there. You're a product of the Gary school system. You're successful. What do you say to people who have who've kind of felt like throw their hands up in the air that Gary, it's going to be tough to turn that around? You got a new mayor in there, of course, who's been there now for almost a year. What do you say to people who feel that Gary can't turn the corner?
Well, I want to say that I was just inspired by Mayor Prince and his vision to reimagine Gary. We need that new vision in Gary. And believe it or not, it's happening in front of our very eyes. We have reimagined Gary, and now we're seeing these changes actually take root and take place. We're seeing dilapidated buildings come down. We're seeing industry come back into the city. We're seeing jobs come back into the city. And all of this is happening in the midst of COVID. So where there is a will, there is a way. And I'm just inspired by the people and the children. I've dedicated my entire life career. I've 22 years. I've worked with children. I'm a speech language pathologist. I work in special education. And our children are deserving of this. We need to reimagine our schools and think back to a time when our schools were a beacon around the nation. People came to Gary to want to teach. It was, you know, just the place to be. I can just name off the top of my head Coach Gene Johnson. He was my coach at Gary Westside High School. He was my mom's coach when she attended Gary Westside High School. And he came here from Philadelphia to teach because it just was had this national reputation of being this great place, this innovative place. There are so many people that came to Gary to teach. People traveled all around the world, and we must remember that and be inspired by that. And we can return to that again. There are many people here with talent, and all we have to do is to hone those skills, bring those people back, and believe that once again it can happen. And I mean, I'm not naive about this. I know it's going to be a lot of work, and I certainly know I can't do it alone, but I'm willing to put in the work. I know I'll get a few more gray hairs, but the children are worth it. Our children deserve a world-class education in the city that they live in.
You know, as you begin your term in January, is there one or two goals that you hope to accomplish in that first four-year term on the Gary School Board?
Mm-hmm. Well, right now, my platform as a candidate was threefold. I am a speech pathologist, so I'm really concerned about literacy, and that is something that has been at the heart of my work for quite some years now. I owned and operated a clinic in Chicago, private practice, and a colleague of mine, or a student of mine, actually, she was there completing her education, her graduate degree, and I was her supervisor. She came on and continued to work for us. And she went to the University of Kansas. And I don't know if your listeners are aware, but the University of Kansas is a literacy mecca. Everyone comes there to learn about what is best practice as it relates to reading instruction. So I've been in communication with professors at the University of Kansas to develop a reading and a literacy program, because reading is at the root of everything. If you're not literate and a fluent reader and have great comprehension by grade three, you're going to have trouble in school, period. So that is just at the root of what I see as important. Also, my background is in special education. That was a trouble area in the Gary Community School Corporation, and it's near and dear to my heart. So another thing, once you get that special education department in order, oh, people hear about you. People will move into your area from far and wide to access those services. So, and there is no great city without a great school system. So that's very, really very important to me. Another platform, a point of my platform, was the arts programming. We have such a great history here in Gary of the arts. Coming out of Emerson School and Gary Westside High School, we have Larry Brewer, who headed the program at Emerson for many, many years. And we have Mark Spencer, still here at Westside, we thank you, who's working on that program there. But I want them to be supported. And I want their theater to be beautiful. I don't want people to have to come into the Gary Westside Theater and see buckets collecting water from the leaking ceiling. These are the types of improvements we want to make so that people can access and enjoy the services that the schools offer, and our children can feel proud to attend those schools. And then the third point of my platform was place-based learning, honoring the place you're in, learning about the city that you live in. Once you learn about where you are, you learn to love it. You learn the history of the place. We have a national park in our first district. What could be better? I mean, we can access Ranger Kip over there in the Indiana Dunes Park. We know him well, my children and I, as do many people in the First District. Why aren't we working with the Indiana Dunes National Park to create programming to get our children out into their environment and learn about science and learn about math right in our parks? There's so many great things we can do, and it's all possible. It just takes the will and someone to put in the work, and I'm willing to do it for our children.
I think you're right. I think a lot of children, not just in Gary, but throughout Northwest Indiana, they don't realize that there is a national park. They look at it as possibly just a beach, but it's so much more than that. It's a national attraction. Now it's a tourist attraction.
Yes.
And indeed, a learning center.
It's a jewel right here, you know, in our midst that has not been recognized.
Well, Kelia McCain is the newest member of the Gary Community School Board. Kelia, thank you so much for joining us here on Off Mic, and I wish you nothing but the best and good luck in the future.
Thank you so very much for having me.
Thank you, and we'll be back with more Off Mic. Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente, reporter with WBEZ in Chicago. Well, we're back talking to you about the great debate. It's the thing that people are talking about. No, not the presidential debate about who should be the next manager of the Chicago White Sox. Well, they made that decision, and it's former, used to coach the Chicago White Sox back in the 80s, Tony La Russa. We thought it was going to be sort of a big joke on people, but it turned out to be true. And here to talk about it a little bit is veteran Chicago sports reporter from WBEZ, Cheryl Ray Stout. Hey, Cheryl, how are you?
I'm good. How about you?
Good. Now, when you first heard, I think you were on the show where we talked a little bit about these rumors about Tony La Russa, not just rumors, a story written by Bob Nightingale. Right. Did you really think it would happen, or did it really catch you even by surprise?
It caught me by surprise, but the more I looked into it, the more I sourced it, it became a reality. And I got to tip my cap to Bob Nightingale. But if you had the time to listen to what Tony said to us, we talked to him after he got the job, it made a lot of sense. Although I don't think it was Rick Hahn's, his preferred hire at that time. But the fact is, Tony has won 3 World Series with 2 different teams. He's in the Hall of Fame. He's very, very smart. He still has his wits about him big time, even though he's 76 years old, and a lot of people are going to say, oh, he's too old. I don't think so. Even Tim Anderson said yesterday when we talked to him, he doesn't think that age is going to matter with Tony La Russa. So it's going to be interesting, but you do have somebody that has a very, very high baseball acumen. And also, one of the biggest traits is he speaks Spanish, and that's going to be important with this team.
That's awesome. You know, before we go any further, I do want to bring people up to the latest on the presidential race. This is cross from the Associated Press. According to the Associated Press, Joe Biden's campaign says he will be giving a speech during prime time tonight. The Democratic presidential candidate's campaign announced that he would be making an address, but did not say where or what he plans to say. So you got a little bit of an update right now during this sports. And I guess like for everybody, not just what's going on with the pandemic, but even politics has just consumed everybody. And I guess I'm sure it's no different with professional athletes.
No, in fact, there was so much of a push for voting with all the athletes, all the teams. And we saw the United Center where the Bulls play and the Blackhawks play, that was opened up for a polling center. So, there was a lot of things where sports were intertwined with this. You look what happened in Georgia. The fact is the WNBA team down there, Atlanta, was very, very big down there for voting. So it has been part of our culture that has seeped into sports. Sports and politics have always been hand in hand since way back when Jesse Owens was given the cold shoulder by Hitler.
You know, Cheryl, talking about that, that's one of the things people were talking about with Tony La Russa. Will he be able to accommodate people like Tim Anderson? Tim Anderson's very politically active, politically engaged, and we do know today's athletes, they can, protest out from, not playing in a game if they feel there was something that happened between a police and another individual. Mm-hmm. We've seen that happen this summer. Do you think he will be able to manage in this sort of new era of political activism in professional sports?
He was talked about that subject because of something he had said in 2016 about the kneeling with the national anthem. And he talked about how he learned through, talking to other people. And he wasn't the only one that had that negative view. There wasn't anybody in baseball supporting what was going on except for one player, and that was Bruce Maxwell of the Oakland A's, and he got cut. And eventually, he just signed a minor league contract with the Mets. But do you know who was one of the persons that actually talked to Bruce Maxwell to get him to understand him and to also help him? Was Tony La Russa. Wow. So people learned from how he felt a few years ago. And the awakening of the players and the awakening of the leagues happened this year. Specifically, it became broader. We did have the Colin Kaepernicks, we did have other people, but it wasn't until this year when things were closed down and George Floyd happened, his murder happened, that the awareness, the ability, and the having the support, that was important, getting the support of management. And that's what Tony La Russa learned, and he has to realize that will continue with players like Tim Anderson and others on the team.
Yeah, because for forever, people looked at sports as a sort of an escape from all that, mm-hmm. and didn't really want to see all the political activism in sports. They say that's why, viewership for the NBA and other sports may be down, but I'm not sure how you can ignore it. I mean, these are humans. They breathe and eat everything we do, and they're a lot of times politically active. Going back to Muhammad Ali.
absolutely. Muhammad Ali was the pinnacle of that, and it's incumbent on people to realize that these players understand. They know they have a platform, and they're not doing it for negativity. They're looking at it positive. They're looking at a way to improve things. It's not, they want to see a better life for themselves, for their families, and for everyone else. It's not, I don't sense any negativity. I think the pandemic has really been the cloud of sports, why viewership is down and why, people are having, so many issues, because the pandemic has really rocked the sports world.
That's right. All right. Well, let's get a little quick update. We only got about another 4 or 5 minutes with the Chicago Bears. We do know they had a COVID scare this week. Give us a little update on that.
Yes, they had two players that had tested positive. One player that was put on the COVID risk list, and that was Jermaine Ifedi. He was taken off this morning. They did cancel practice yesterday because they had the second test of Cody Whitehair. They, went back to Zoom meetings. But as of today, they're back to normal activities. We talked to a few players today, Jimmy Graham, Khalil Mack. You know, this is their world now. This is something with all the uptick so high for COVID. They know every day, every week, every game there could be a scare, and this is their life. But they are playing on Sunday in Tennessee. It's going to be interesting because they're going to be facing Derrick Henry, who is a load to bring down. They also have, you know, there's a lot of things about their offense that could be a little scary, but the Bears have to figure out how their offensive line, which is ragtag right now with injury and the COVID issues, being able to perform.
You know, Cheryl, just getting back to our earlier conversation, just one more question on the politics side. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, back a few years ago, Charles Barkley had said something like that, you know, players shouldn't be considered role models, which almost seems a little absurd. You know, have you spoken to, like, athletes on do they view themselves as role models? It almost seems like impossible that they wouldn't.
They understand that, especially because of social media. Social media has actually jettisoned them into the public view even more. So everything they say, everything they do is always going to be talked about and analyzed and being part of their fabric. So, you know, what Charles said, that was years ago, and I don't think that even applies anymore. I think they know that they're role models. And that's what, you know, they do a lot of these players do things in schools. They work with, you know, literacy rates. They do a lot of things that are very positive. So that's part of being a role model.
All right. And when do we know when the next NBA season will start?
Well, they actually the union agreed with the league to start it in December 22nd. They will have 72 games, so it will be reduced. They'll have camps opening up on December 1st. They have to amend the collective bargaining agreement because they're going to have to be some trade-offs with money and change that. The draft is November 18th. The trade moratorium is supposed to be lifted before then. Free agency is going to be rather quickly. So on December 1st, they're going to open up the camps. It's going to be a wild, wacky, if they can do it.
Well, Cheryl Ray Stout, you can follow all her reporting on Twitter, Facebook. I'm not sure if you're on Instagram. She reports for WBEZ and is truly a groundbreaking reporter and a treasure. And we just love always hearing her here on Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. So thank you so much, Cheryl.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you. And we just want to give everybody a little bit more of an update as we close out this show. We only got a couple of more minutes left. Just so you know, there has been an announcement. Nothing has been called yet, but Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden will have some remarks tonight. It's not sure when it's going to happen or exactly what he's going to say, but that's according to the Associated Press that they're saying that Joe Biden will give a speech during prime time tonight. So we'll await that. And, of course, you can continue to monitor the election on Lakeshore Public Radio and with National Public Radio. As it stands, nothing has been called. Pennsylvania is still working its way. Georgia, North Carolina, Nevada. So we're awaiting word on that. And it looks like it's going to be a nail biter. And can't wait to talk to you again next week at this time. We could have a new president, president-elect, or we can still be with Donald Trump. It's not over for him yet. And there's a lot of legal challenges, as we know. So we hope you enjoyed the show. You can catch this again as a podcast by going to lakeshorepublicradio.org. So I want to thank my producers, Jose Rodriguez, sitting right next to me with his NPR Lakeshore Public Radio mask, Tom Maloney, who sat in earlier and going through some of the numbers and giving some great analysis. And, of course, the fabulous Dee Dotson, always fashionable. Just love working with them. So you can hear me the rest of the week on WBEZ. But for Lakeshore Public Radio, thank you for listening and stay safe.